Is evil real? Is it a metaphor for the bad things people do, or does it prowl the earth like a living, breathing entity that possesses the souls of vulnerable humans? That's what we're going to discuss this evening. Ron Felber is back. So is his new book, The Unwelcomed. That's next, right here on the very best in paranormal programming. I'm Dave Schrader. This is my Paranormal 60.
I'm not gonna stand here and listen to this baloney.
He won't float. He doesn't stand for baloney.
Sounds like a lot of supernatural baloney to me.
Supernatural, perhaps. Baloney, perhaps not.
Hello, my little darklings far and wide. Thank you for tuning in tonight for another edition of the Paranormal 60. I want to thank everybody that was just out at the Cajun Country Paracon. It was a delight to meet all of you. We had a great time investigating a lot of strange activity taking place. I caught some amazing EVP, and not in the way I expected. Although we were in a very haunted theater in a very haunted town, as the spirits began to quiet down in the location we were at, I began doing an EVP seance session with some of the actual attendees, and we got direct responses from the ghosts that they believe were with them. It was fascinating night, amazing time, and I was so glad to get a chance to meet so many of you out there. And how many of you came to my table already possessing a copy of my book? Thank you so much for doing that, picking the book up. It is out and available. And for those of you that said, nah, I'm going to wait for the ebook copy, well, wait no longer, my darklings. It is available. You can find it now on Amazon. So go get your ebook copy and start reading it now. And keep up those amazing ratings and reviews. Guys, I love it. Honest ratings and reviews. I appreciate it wholeheartedly. And we are so close to 100 reviews already. Trust me when I say this, it really does go a long way to help the authors that you respect and like, and even me. So make sure that you rate and review these books, because that, with the algorithms they have on Amazon, opens up the book to more and more readers around the world. So please bear that in mind as we talk to many different guests on this program about all of the great content that they're creating out there. And your reading, it takes no more than 30 seconds to go rate and review a book on Amazon.com. So please do that. Speaking of books on Amazon.com, our guest this evening, Ron Felber, is the author of an award-winning thrillers and investigative nonfiction books. We have had him on in the past in my career, and he is back tonight to join us to talk about his new book. And I am excited to have you here to do this. Ron, thank you so much for joining us again.
Dave, my pleasure. It's always a pleasure.
The Unwelcomed. This is The Curious Case of Clara Fowler. The book will be out and available officially in May, but the pre-order is available now, and it really helps. Go out there, get the pre-order in, make sure that you let everybody know that you got the book, and spread word like wildfire. This book is definitely something you're going to absolutely love. As a matter of fact, let's take a little look at the trailer.
Boston, 1898. Clara Fowler arrives at the office of renowned psychotherapist Dr. Morton Prince, plagued by visions, exalted by apparitions of the Virgin Mary, cursed by a demonic presence obsessed with her demise. A city marshal pursues Clara, hell-bent on pinning the murders of her infant siblings on her father and uncovering their connection to the serial killings of Jack the Ripper and H.H. Holmes. What happens next is more shocking than the grizzled lawman could ever imagine.
The Unwelcomed by Ron Felber. Pre-order on Amazon or where books are sold.
Looks spooky, looks good. It's right down the alley of my listeners and followers around the world, Ron. And I love the fact that obviously this is a novel, but you've based this case on real things. And I want to talk first a little bit just to give people a taste of it. The trailer's great, but introduce us to The Unwelcomed.
Yeah, it's really a story of demonic possession that was documented by a number of Harvard Medical School lecturers, people like William James, the famous William James, who was the father of abnormal psychiatry, Dr. Morton Prince, Dr. George Waterman, all Harvard Medical School graduates and practitioners. And Prince was really a kind of unparalleled in those days. This would be 1898 to 1904 or so, unparalleled courses with Sigmund Freud, who was also familiar with this case. So a young Radcliffe student, 22 years old, goes to a Dr. Putnam. She's very religious. She claims to have visitations from the Virgin Mary and from Jesus Christ. She prays constantly, and Prince, in his book, Dissociation of a Personality, refers to her as the saint. So this is the woman that we're talking about, Clara Fowler. Suddenly she starts to have these awful nightmares. Nightmares where she's in a procession of hooded figures, demonic presences, demons that loom over her bed at night. She wakes up to find her money ripped up and destroyed, and threatening letters like, "When are you going to put a bullet through your head? This body is mine." And she has missing time, so she doesn't know when the demonic presence has taken over. So Putnam, who was basically a general practitioner, says, "You know, this is way above my pay grade. I can't deal with this," because she's very violent in this second stage, talks in a man's voice, explosive loudness and vitriolic, hate-filled. Her face remolds, literally remolds into a different face. Mm-hmm. So Putnam says, "You know," in a letter, which I have in the book, says to Prince, "I don't know what to do with this. I just know that I don't know enough about it to hope to cure whatever's wrong with her. But my observation is that in other times, they would refer to this as demonic possession." So a team is formed by Prince, William James, Waterman, and interestingly enough, a clairvoyant named Leonora Piper, mm-hmm. and the president of the Boston chapter of the Society of Psychical Researchers, who was a spiritualist. So spiritualism was very popular in those days.
Right.
There were about 9 million people that believed firmly in spiritualism. Charles Dickens or Arthur Conan Doyle, Madame Curie, just a lot of luminaries. And so Prince wanted to get different perspectives on this, even though he was convinced from the very beginning that this was a natural phenomenon and that it was an illness. Demonic possession was an illness that had yet to be diagnosed and certainly not cured.
Very cool. Now, you obviously have written a wide variety of different books, fiction and nonfiction alike. Mm-hmm. What is it about a story that attracts you to the premise, and especially with something like this going, you know, this deep into the high strangeness?
Yeah. Well, you know, there's an interesting story behind how I got this story. I was a student at Georgetown University, and I was a sophomore, I guess, and they were filming The Exorcist. So William Peter Blatty was there with Billy Friedkin, the director. And I was this young guy with longer hair than now. And
weren't we all?
And a manuscript. Right? And this is one of these yellow pages manuscripts with typos all over, you know, your first shot at a book. And so I said, "I've got to meet this guy. He's got a bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list for 56 weeks. You know, I want to meet him. Maybe he'll read my book. Maybe he'll love it, and maybe he'll help me get it published." So it was impossible to meet Bill Blatty because he was filming during the day. But I heard that he had an office across the Potomac from Georgetown at the Marriott Key Bridge. So I went over there with my manuscript in hand and basically begged his administrative assistant to show him this manuscript. And she said, "You know, I'll tell you what, I'll put it in the pile with the others." There's this mountain of manuscripts from Germany, France, Canada, Mexico, England, you know, 50, 60, 70 manuscripts.
Right.
"No, no, 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 don't do that. I'm a student at Georgetown just like he was. He grew up in the Bronx. I grew up in Newark. I got here on a scholarship, a financial scholarship, Scholastic as well. And so did he. He wanted to be a writer. I want to be a writer. Just tell him I'm like he was 20 years ago. And please take a look at my manuscript." So he did. He liked it. He gave a call when I was on Thanksgiving break back in New Jersey. Said he liked it. Said he wanted to meet. And we met. He didn't help me with that book because it wasn't good enough. But he did help me with a second book. And the best thing he did was tell me about some research he had uncovered on this woman named Clara Fowler in Boston, the turn of the century, and called it one of the most authentic cases and most studied cases of demonic possession that he had encountered. And so between that case history, the Fowler case, and the case history of a 14-year-old boy, 12, 14-year-old boy in Maryland, it took place in 1949 when he was a student at Georgetown, that really comprised the basis for The Exorcist.
Yeah, and boy, what a nice little blurb you've got on your book as well from William Peter Blatty before he passed away, right?
Yes.
Amazing. Or maybe you got it afterwards, which make it even more amazing.
That would make it even more amazing. So to answer your question, what do I look for? I look for something I'm going to live with for 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, I lived with this story for 50 years because I tried to write it early along and it was just too difficult. You know, setting something turn of the century as a writer, maybe you can imagine, how do you draw the character of Sigmund Freud or how do you draw the character of William James? And so it was just too difficult for me at that time. So 50 years went by or so. And I said, you know, let me look at this again. I have all the research. I have photographs. I have transcripts of the hypnotic sessions. I have letters that went between them, between the demonic presence and the saint, as she was called. And so I said, let me give another shot at this. And I did. And lo and behold, it came out just fine.
That's amazing. Boy, to kind of get that seed planted 50 years ago and let it germinate and keep working on it till your craft catches up to the story.
Exactly.
That's an interesting way to look at it, right? Because the story was always there. Your craft was building and evolving all these years.
Exactly.
And you finally reached the level where you could tell this story and tell it in a dynamic way.
I wanted to do was make a kind of, it's based on a true story. And as a matter of fact, the dialogue between the doctor and the patient, and it really a lot of it is comprised of these interactions, some of them violent, some of them just mind-blowing, really come from the transcripts. I cleaned it up because they might use a word like whilst that kind of old English sort of thing. And so I modernized it a bit, but by and large, in terms of the sessions between the doctor and the demonic presence and the so-called saint, they're pretty straightforward from the transcripts.
When you have the access to this, now, first of all, how hard was that to get? I mean, especially that long a period of time between when it took place and when you were able to access it, how hard was that?
I'll tell you what, and this is really, I'm sort of blessed with this whole situation, but Blatty and I became pretty good friends. I mean, I would see him every couple of years, maybe when I had something I wanted to show him, but he promised me, because he obviously made a lot of money on The Exorcist and owned a lot of homes, you know, in Aspen and Beverly Hills and Georgetown, et cetera. And he moved a lot. So he said, you know, I promise my wife will send you, or I'll send you my address. If I move, you'll know about it so that we can keep in touch. And he was true to his word. And what he also did was to call ahead to the Harvard Medical School Library, where he had done his research and knew the curator, and said, I have a friend, a young man that is going to be coming in. Please grant him access to all the files. So this was a treasure trove of information that you couldn't wish for. So I won't say it fell in my lap, because I was kind of tenacious in getting it, and I was very tenacious in studying it. You know, I spent many hours in that library pouring through papers and transcripts, but it was well worth it, because I think this is probably the best book I've ever written, and I'm very proud of it.
Excellent. I personally can't wait to get my hands on it and dig through not just the parts of the manuscript you were willing to share with me up front, so I didn't give anything good away on the show tonight. But again, it is out and it's available for pre-order right now, folks. So please pre-order the book. It helps a publisher know how many books to get printed and ready to go. The book is available on Amazon.com and wherever you buy, wherever you purchase your books. But go pre-order it now. So as soon as it hits in May, you are going to get that first copy as they come off the assembly line and get them shipped out to you immediately. Now, when you're going through these cases and you're talking to William Peter Blatty, the man behind the Exorcist book.
Yes.
Again, an amazing novelization based on a very true story, fictionalized. And of course, you know, certain things changed to protect the innocent throughout. I want to know, Ron, what is your take on possession and exorcisms? Do you believe demonic forces are entering people and taking them over?
Dave, I'm going to give you an answer that's unlikely. But true.
Okay.
I used to transport federal prisoners. Mm-hmm. When I got out of Georgetown, there was a tremendous recession. No one was hiring. And I tried to be a writer, and that I just couldn't get a job. So what I did do was to become a deputy sheriff in Arlington, Virginia. And part of that job was to transport prisoners. At the time, the federal prisoners from Washington, D.C., it was overrun, the jails there. So they would house in the Arlington, Virginia facility these terrorists, hitmen, I mean, real and true killers,
right,
and real and true evil men. And in dealing with some of those, not all, a lot of the criminals were misunderstood and just not capable of coping with the outside world. But
right,
then you'll meet a handful and you'll say, this man is possessed. This man killed 80 people and he likes it. He doesn't kill for money. He does it because he likes to hurt things. And if you look into a guy's eyes like that and you talk to him for hours, as I have, and you feel like you're dealing with a man that is possessed and has surrendered his soul to evil forces. And in that sense, absolutely. Do I believe in demonic possession? Hands down, yes. Yeah.
When you are confronted with one of these criminals who, I mean, we do know that there are broken people. There are sociopaths that just have absolutely no whims about killing. Mm-hmm. You know, there are streets overrun with thugs and urban terrorists, if you will, you know, make it a practice to kill somebody every couple of days just because they can and they're able to get away with it.
Yeah.
So my thought is, you know, when you're sitting there looking at them, how do you tell the difference between just somebody who's just a broken piece of societal wheel and somebody with a true evil, you know, not just an evil nature, but infested with evil.
Yeah. I don't want to get too graphic. I don't really want to do that. I just don't want to for your viewer, you know, for your audience's sake and whatnot. But, you know, I've met people that took 14-year-old girls and tortured them for days.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, so if you're asking me, you can look in the eyes, you can feel, you walk in the room, you can feel the darkness. And so that's the difference. There's a lot of people that are mixed up. There's a lot of people that panic. There's a lot of people that do stupid things, crazy things. Many times they're on drugs, PCP or angel dust or, you know, whatever it might be. It just makes them crazy. But I'm not talking about people like that. I'm talking about someone where you walk in, you look in their eyes, and you know that this is something else. What can I say? You feel it.
You know, in a lot of instances, when people come upon somebody that is possessed, these beings who you don't know seem to know a lot about you. Did you ever run into that personally, Ron? Where?
Well, no, I haven't, but certainly Morton Prince did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was, you know, this was in the second state, as we'll call it. We'll call it the second consciousness, the demonic state, whatever you want to call it. This was, as I mentioned, a situation where the voice became a deep baritone voice, the face remolded into something pretty hideous. It had the strength of, you know, five men. It was clairvoyant and could talk to Prince and tell him, you know, you will lose you know, because they would fight. Literally, this being would get violent and had to be restrained, and would make threats and whatnot, and actually physically attack the doctors. But, you know, you will lose the thing that you love most tomorrow. And the next day, he had a prize horse named Garland that, you know, was his, he rode every day. It was his love of his life, truly, was hit by a car and died. So that kind of thing, you know, the spooky, weird kind of stuff was going on. The second consciousness had no need of food, never was ill, was awake 24/7, hated anything religious or anything to do with religion and would rage at it, felt no pain, needed no sleep. And the thing of it is, this isn't no knock on religious people or priests or ministers or whatever, but they'll come to something with a particular point of view.
Right.
These guys didn't come to it with a particular point of view. And so, you know, when they're witnessing these things, particularly Hogson, who was the psychical researcher, and Leonora Piper, who was the clairvoyant, I mean, they knew right away what was going on. This was a presence that entered the body of this woman. Of course, Prince, being in competition with Freud for really the direction that psychiatry would go, Prince thought, and, you know, many would agree now even or then, that psychoanalysis was garbage. He called it rubbish.
Okay.
He was a behavioralist, which gets a lot more credibility these days, meaning if somebody's a schizophrenic, it isn't because, they had a bad sex life or something. They're schizophrenic because of an imbalance, a chemical imbalance in their brain.
Right.
So these were the two different, totally different points of view. So Freud had published Interpretations of a Dream, I think in 1901, and it took the world by storm. It was about psychoanalysis. Prince thought that this case, if he could shine the sanitizing light of scientific research,
right,
demonic possession, and show that it was a functional illness, a damaged brain, lesions, whatever it might be, that he could overshadow Freud in this competition to see which direction psychiatry would go in. So he had a vested interest in calling it dissociation, disguising the identity of the woman, and actually leaving out some really significant pieces of information in his in the book that he wrote, which was called Dissociation of a Personality, and it came out in 1906.
When you start looking into these things, there's a lot of stories told by authors and investigators, exorcists, lay exorcists, the people that help on that. When they start digging into these stories, weird things begin happening in their own lives. Was that a concern for you? Did that even register for you when you decided to tackle this story finally 50 years later and really get into it?
Yeah. I can't say that I'm immune to those kinds of thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, this is something that's kind of creepy. I talked to a priest about this, and he said, I'll talk to you about it, but first we're going to pray to shield ourselves, you know, to shield ourselves from what they call infection.
Right.
So as a matter of fact, in Aldous Huxley, the mm-hmm. famous writer, Doors of Perception and whatnot, Aldous Huxley wrote a book called The Devils of Loudun. And this would be in France, where a nunnery was had an epidemic of demonic possessions. And they sent four priests to stem the epidemic through exorcisms. Three of the priests died within a year after.
Hmm.
And the other spent the last 25 years of his life in a lunatic asylum. So the prospect of infection or attachments is something that's kind of demonstrable. It's something that's happened. From my standpoint, my own view is you have to invite this in. Now, they talk about maybe a Ouija board or maybe a black mass or maybe just hanging around with somebody that's a Satanist, just, or maybe hanging around with somebody that is themselves possessed, like the people I'm talking about. You hang around with a killer, like the kinds of people I was talking to you about, you hang around with them for a year and see what you're like. That's infection. Yeah. But I think you have to kind of invite it in. I think if you're pretty stalwart in your beliefs, and I think that that's a kind of protection, maybe not a foolproof protection. I'll let you know in a couple of years.
Well, here's the part that kind of rings my bell about this, because like you, I've heard stories of these cases where the priests often end up losing their lives doing this. You've got a nunnery. You've got chaste women who have donated, given their lives over to Christ, to do good.
Yeah.
And an entire infection spreads throughout the rectory, and they become possessed or oppressed. Mm-hmm. And then the priests that go into battle it die. It makes you wonder if this has nothing to do with theology at all, nothing to do with demonic realm as the Bible puts it forward, mm-hmm. but that these beings predate anything. And that's why it is such a battle and a war to evict these beings, and that the people that stand toe to toe with them, it's not so much about God. It's about belief and hanging in, trying to do this. And I'm not trying to dissuade people from religion at all.
That's not my point.
But it seems to me that, yes, it would be the best for Satan and his army to corrupt an entire nunnery and priests.
That's very interesting.
But on the other side of it, they should be the most protected beings on the planet, because they are the ones propagating and doing the good work.
Yeah.
And if they're not protected, what do Ron Felber and Dave Schrader hope to have as in the line of protection?
Well, you know, the whole thing is kind of intimidating from that standpoint, because, yeah, I agree with you. I think these are ancient. This is an ancient battle that's been going on way before you and I were on this earth. Norman Mailer, the writer, I put this at the back of the book, and this is what he had to say in an interview about human existence, I guess. The devil might be a presence from another universe. We might be fighting an implacable enemy out there, and the devil might be the agent of the implacable enemy, with God as the tired general fighting that war with his own agents of hope. You know, even if you go back to something like Crime and Punishment with Dostoevsky, the famous Russian writer, novelist, I mean, basically his belief isn't so different from what I think. He looks at the forces of evil and the forces mm-hmm. of good. Call it a god, call it a devil, but forces. And human beings are kind of in the middle. And human beings are the prize for either side. And the more I look at things, and particularly the more I look at things in light of the new physics, in light of quantum mechanics, where physicists now are starting to believe in a creator or something, you know, like Aristotle called the unmoved mover.
Right.
At some point in time, you might have dominoes that are falling all over the place for, you know, 1,000 miles. But somebody says, well, who pushed the first domino?
Right.
I mean, somebody pushed the first domino, the unmoved mover. And a lot of physicists, starting with Sir Francis Crick, who was the co-founder of DNA, you know, has a firm belief that we know nothing about reality. That basically, you know, we have like a pinhole that we look through, and what we see is what we need to see to survive. How do we get water? How do we get food? How do we procreate? How do we keep ourselves warm? That's what our brain is conditioned to see. And so there's a huge world out there that we're absolutely blind to. And I think that huge world that we're absolutely blind to is a spiritual one. And one that's primordial, as you say. It goes back to ancient times and before.
Ron Felber is our guest. The brand new book is out and available to pre-order right now. It'll be released in May of this year. You want to go ahead and get yourself a copy of it so that you don't miss out. We will return. We've got more to discuss, including the possible connections between Jack the Ripper and H.H. Holmes, possession, oppression, and what it takes to beat the unsurmountable or insurmountable odds of true evil. We'll discuss that and so much more when we return to the best in paranormal programming. I'm Dave Schrader. This is the Paranormal 60. My favorite spring cleaning takeaway is the post-clean clarity that you get. That, wow, how have I been living like this feeling? It's kind of like when you find out that you've been paying a fortune for wireless when Mint Mobile has phone plans for just $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. Wow, how have I been affording this? It's time to switch to Mint Mobile and get unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. The quality that I've received from Mint Mobile is second to none, and I've tried them all. And this is an amazing company to work with that actually cares about their clients and the prices that they charge. So if you're on that fence wondering, should I make the shift? You're going to get great coverage, you're going to get great customer service, and all of the bells and whistles you expect from the bigger brand names. Say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plans and their jaw-dropping monthly bills and unexpected overages. Mint Mobile is here to rescue you with premium wireless plans starting at just $15 a month. So to get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/P60. That's mintmobile.com/P60. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/P60. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to just $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Okay, my little darklings, I know, just by looking at me, you think that guy does not work out. Well, you'd be right. And aside from just looking at me and knowing I don't work out, I was quickly reminded of the fact that I don't work out because I've got subscriptions to not one, not two, but 3 different apps to help me maintain my weight and get in shape and feel better. 3 apps that I worked diligently when I first signed up for them for about a week and then forgot all about them. But thankfully, Rocket Money didn't forget about them. I'd forgotten all about 3, not one, not two, but 3 different subscriptions to 3 different organizations. And here I am, still dumb, still fat, and losing money every month without even paying attention to it. I think some of you out there might understand the predicament I'm in, and that's why you need to get Rocket Money. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending, and it helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. With Rocket Money, I have full control over all of my subscriptions and a clear view of exactly where my money is going. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved now a total of 500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. So stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/P60. That's rocketmoney.com/P60. rocketmoney.com/P60.
In winter's grasp, a chilling tale unfolds. Wanted Magazine's issue 40, Secrets to be Told. Al Capone's ghost, in shadows it creeps. A spectral mobster, where darkness seeps. 14 signs of a poltergeist's might, haunting whispers in the silent night. Pascagoula UFO, 50 years gone by, a cosmic encounter reaching the sky. The ghost train of Tate Bridge echoes in the mist. a phantom journey where souls exist. Wanted magazine issue 40 is out now, available from selected outlets and bit.ly/hauntedmagazine. Don't be normal, be paranormal.
We have a link up for Haunted Magazine on today's program guide, and yours truly is in the brand new edition. So make sure that you go order yourself a copy. It's a great magazine. If you have not yet seen this and you are a fan of all things paranormal, get yourself a copy. It is a great magazine, not just because I'm on the cover. I mean, that certainly helps it become an even better magazine, but you owe it to yourself to read it, check it out for yourself. Go check out the link on today's program guide. Speaking of which, we've got links for our guest's book right here so you can find it even more easily. So whether you're watching us live on YouTube right now or social media, the live streams, or you're listening to this later on, there is a link for the book in today's description. So make sure you go pre-order that book right now and get yourself a copy. Ron Felber is our guest. The Unwelcome, The Curious Case of Clara Fowler is the name of the book. It is a novelization of a real case, a real study, where science and the supernatural come together in a very unbelievable and amazing way. And were you surprised, Ron, especially with the era and the time we were in? Obviously, spiritualism was a big thing. There were believers worldwide from every walk of life in the spiritualist realm. So it wasn't so far removed, but there was still a divide between spiritualism, religion, and science. Were you surprised at how science was kind of rolling with this punch as opposed to, oh, this can't be real. This is, you know, this just doesn't add up in the world of science.
Well, you see, as I mentioned, Dr. Morton Prince was kind of obsessed with pointing psychiatry in the direction of behavioralism as opposed to Freud and psychoanalysis. So being a smart guy, he determined, you know, if I just take it from my point of view, a scientific point of view, people are going to say, the spiritualists will all say, well, you went in with your mind made up. Mm-hmm. So if somebody is talking in languages that they never, you know, could never know, you'll figure out some scientific explanation. Well, there's some part of the brain that, you know, is capable of doing that and make it a scientific treatise. So he was smart enough to get a buy-in. And what he was trying to do was to get Hodgson and Leonora Piper on the side of him and Waterman and James. But he actually, even William James, by the end, you know, referred to this as the demon. And, you know, he goes, in a letter that he writes, and I start the book with, to Morton Prince, I read your book, you know, you did a masterful job, etc. But then there's the demon, and that's the dark point. That's how he ends his letter.
Jeez. Yeah. Well, when science, I love the fact that science has had its face slapped a few times throughout history.
Yes.
When science believes that it knows more and it takes a hardened stance, we should know that by now science is a practice. It's an always evolving, ever evolutionizing study, right? And that what we think we know may just be the tip of the iceberg, and that there are deeper roots to different elements of what's going on with ourself and our souls and our spirits. It's been strange. I've watched some friends of mine throughout my life that have had really horrible medical maladies and at one point just kind of turn their life over to Christ and go to church. Just kind of, they're like, I don't know if I've got much time left on this planet, but I'd like to get right with my creator. And the minute they kind of step into this mind frame and mindset, their health begins to improve, their mental stability begins to improve, their connection to their loved ones begins to improve, and it's like an evolutionary ladder that they're stepping on. And science will tell you it's a placebo effect. Science will tell you that you were probably going to go into remission anyway. It just so happened that it timed out with while you were going to church. But we are seeing, and now science is backpedaling on that, saying that there are correlations between your thoughts, the anxiety and stresses that you carry, and the diseases that your body starts to create.
Absolutely. What's an ulcer?
Right.
Yeah, an ulcer is caused by stress, mental stress, and it has a physical reaction. It creates acid in your stomach and eats your stomach, and you wind up with a
Well, and here's the beauty of that. I love using that one as a perfect example as science, because that's what a lot of people believed it was. And there was a scientist who came out and said, no, it's a bacterial infection and we can treat it. And science said, you're an idiot. No, it's not. We would have figured that out. Yes. And lo and behold, it was a bacterial infection. Inspired by the stress, because you were creating so much more, it fed that bacterial.
That's correct.
Right.
Exactly.
So it worked hand in hand. So instead of just dismissing it summarily, instead of looking at it and saying these two things work in conjunction and become even more, it's like the hurricane that hit, Hurricane Katrina. Hurricane Katrina was horrible. Absolutely. But it hit and broke the levees. Had the levees held, it would have been a different story.
Yep.
Right. But it's the two working in conjunction that caused the destruction.
Well, you know, Dave, there's a section in the book, if I can read just a short piece.
Please.
Really the argument between Hogson and Prince. So Prince, of course, is the scientist. Hogson is the spiritualist. So Prince says, throughout the ages, diseases of the mind have been falsely labeled demonic possession by those who would have us believe supernatural entities creep into the natural world. Ghosts, witches, devils. Have we learned nothing from the work of Charcot on the pathology of hysteria and epilepsy? Think for a moment about the poor souls subjected to unspeakable tortures. Women burned at the stake here in Massachusetts, no less, in the name of religion and belief in evil incarnate. When, as Tourette proved, the symptoms associated with Tourette syndrome have nothing to do with demons and everything to do with a chemical imbalance in the brain. Hogson, listen, please. We have a set of symptoms manifested by a second consciousness. As proved by you, it takes possession of Miss Fowler's body, claiming to be spirit, despises her, threatens her, and has driven her to the brink of destruction. Given these facts, one can label her disorder anything one chooses, but a name doesn't explain a phenomenon that's existed in every corner of the year of the earth for thousands of years. Then Prince, anecdotes. That's what you put forward, Hogson. Where are the doctors? Where are the clinicians, scientists who would document these stories? Without that, we have what we always have in a spiritualist argument: hearsay, fraud, misunderstanding, symptoms leading to misdiagnosis and mythology. Hogson steps forward pleading. Don't you see, Morton? Can you not bring yourself to understand the great mystery we stand on the threshold of solving? I beg you. Consider at least the possibility that here at last, in the city of Boston, 1898, is tangible evidence of transcendence. If there are demons, there must be angels and probably a God and a life everlasting. You ask, where are the doctors and clinicians? Dr. Prince, we are the doctors. We are the clinicians. And that's really in a nutshell. You know, you see, if you see through a lens, a particular lens, and I see through a particular lens, the same, you know, phenomenon, you know, you will come up with the explanation that fits your philosophy, and I'll come up with the one that fits mine.
And what has ophthalmology taught us? That sometimes you need two lenses in the same frame in order to see the full spectrum of the picture.
Exactly, right? Correct. Absolutely.
So I like to look at myself more as a scientific revolutionary involvement than just an old guy with bifocals.
Right? There you go. That works for me, Dave.
Exactly. Fascinating stuff. And I love the fact that you're able to take the realist and the real story into this, weave it into a narrative. Obviously, from the trailer we showed, talking about the connections with H.H. Holmes and Jack the Ripper, I do want to kind of touch on that, because we lead off the show showing that in the trailer. I need to know what the connection is.
Well, you know, there's a very real connection, because there's a detective involved. So this is a book, I call it a book of science, murder, and the paranormal. Mm-hmm. Yes, there are three murders that are involved in this story. And a detective, actually, it was a city marshal named Rufus Bassett, like Bassett Hound, Rufus Bassett Hilliard. And he was a city marshal from Falls River. And he was the one that investigated the Lizzie Borden axe murders and had investigated the Juan Corey Arrow axe murders. So you have a city, Fall River, in Massachusetts, of sort of an industrial town, pre-industrial. And they have two vicious, violent murders within 4 miles of each other, within 6 months of each other. This is a place that hadn't had a murder in 50 years. Now you have these two. And this particular city marshal is stuck in the middle of both. And it haunts him. You know, it haunts him to see these horrible atrocities that are mm-hmm. committed. And actually, Clara Fowler had two siblings that had died under suspicious circumstances. And so Hilliard Bassett goes to Boston thinking that Clara could be a witness against her father, who he's convinced committed these murders. And what mm-hmm. he finds out is that Clara is with Dr. Prince being treated for demonic possession. And this is the interesting thing, Dave, and this is a fact, okay? Mm-hmm. In a museum in Fall River, they have a museum dedicated to these murders that I talked about. There's a letter that Jack the Ripper wrote to Bassett.
Yeah. Really?
Actual letter from Jack the Ripper to Bassett. And so they checked out the handwriting because Scotland Yard had samples of his handwriting and whatnot. And sure enough, it was a legitimate letter. So it's in right now in the museum there. And, you know, for anybody to see. But there is a connection. I don't want to get into it too deeply, but there is a connection. And I would say this, it has to do with what we talked about early along, which is, you know, infection, which is evil real? Yeah, evil's real. So is goodness, by the way.
You know, I was lucky enough to do a special called The Curse of Lizzie Borden, where we went, Chris Fleming, myself, Sam Beltrusis, Lou Anjali, uh-huh. we went and spent a weekend working there, filming and investigating. And what it really kind of felt like to us through this investigation was that who truly committed the murder, I don't think that will ever be answered, mm-hmm. is in the fact that I believe that if Lizzie Borden was behind it, I don't think it was Lizzie Borden running the ship. I think she may have been the vessel and something else.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, Lizzie Borden and Juan Correo, neither one of them. Juan mm-hmm. Correo butchered his boss's wife with an axe in her kitchen. No apparent reason. Mm-hmm. Violent, you know, incredibly. These were murders that civilized society had never seen before.
Right.
Jack the Ripper, Lizzie Borden, Juan Correo, et cetera. And he had no memory of doing it. As a matter of fact, he left the kitchen and went out and bought himself a pair of shoes, went into town and bought himself a pair of shoes. Lizzie Borden, during the trial, was contradictory all over the place. But one thing that she was not contradictory about was that she was innocent and had no knowledge whatsoever of these murders. And I believe that. I believe that Juan Correo had no knowledge or remembrance of murders, and I believe she had no remembrance of the murders. And as a matter of fact, they talked about how nonchalant she was about all of this. Well, yeah, if you thought you had nothing to do with it, I guess you'd just say, I don't know, I had nothing to do with it. And she wound up being acquitted, but Bassett knew better. There was evidence that they couldn't present in court. You know how that goes sometimes. And mm-hmm. If that evidence had been presented, he was sure that she would have been convicted. And I don't know, maybe they didn't want that.
Ron, can I tell you something that literally just struck me between the eyes like an axe from Lizzie Borden here, right? Mm-hmm. This is, I filmed this special. We did this and started to think that maybe there was possession involved. But part of your brain wants to just kind of push that concept of there's no way something can control you. There's you're still, but there is a moment when we were in Lizzie's bedroom doing a seance and we're all holding hands and everybody's visible. As we're holding hands, you start hearing knocking underneath the table, making a circle around. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, all right, that's weird. Right. And had it just been by Chris, the medium, I'd wonder, or, you know, was it somebody nervously tapping their leg?
Right.
The sound was moving around the table and nobody was moving. Yeah. And then as we were getting into this seance and I've got my eyes closed, Chris's arm starts twitching as I'm holding his hand, and I'm like, what is wrong with this guy? And his arm's just going bonkers, and finally he lets go of my hand, and it's my arm. Wow. And he goes, I know what's happening. Give me a pen and paper. And I start to come out of it, if you will, and he goes, no, stay, Dave. Close your eyes, relax. He gives me a pen, and my arm, I start writing things on the paper. And I got to be honest with you, for the love of God, why this didn't strike us at the time, if you question the authenticity or the belief that possession could happen, it happened in a very short form for me in the fact that I automatic
wrote, writing, yeah,
which I was fighting the entire time. And the one thing that I've said repeatedly is I wish I would have leaned into it a little more and allowed it to happen, because I fought it with such voracious strength, trying to stop the trembling. And my arm, shoulder, and neck hurt for weeks afterwards. And I just wish I would have let the experience happen, because, wow, what a great experience. But on the other side of it, it showed me how strong something was, that it just moved me with whether I wanted it to or not. And even while fighting it, it's able to write. And yes. Ron, this is just hitting me now. And I promise you, this isn't reality TV shenanigans. This happened to me. It's been something that's been eating at the back of my brain for a long time. But my God, here we are trying to say we think this woman might have been possessed.
Yes.
And what can we do to prove that? And for God's sakes, it was right there all along. It showed how easy something could take over and do what it wanted to do.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. No, I think, as I mentioned, I think we have zero truth in terms of what reality really is. I don't think we have any idea what's really real. I think we see what we want to see, and we block out what we don't want to see. As a matter of fact, Huxley and Aldous Huxley in Doors of Perception says the function of the brain isn't what you and I would think, you know, which is to logic, et cetera. It's to screen out reality, because it would blow our minds if we knew what reality really looked like.
Right.
And so I look at these situations, whether it's the Clara Fowler situation or the Hess's situation with the Mojave incident, UFOs and alien abduction, as sort of glimpsing through the screen, you know, where the curtain is just drawn back enough, it gives you a peek into what reality really is.
Yeah. Right. And it is such a minute, it's a grain of sand on a sea of beach, right? Of what we truly understand and what we're capable of. It's fascinating, Ron. What an amazing story to kind of delve back into. And again, if you've just tuned in on the live video and you're watching, we're discussing the real case behind the novel book that is coming out in May called The Unwelcome, The Curious Case of Clara Fowler by Ron Felber, our author friend Ron Felber here with us this evening. There's a link for the book in today's program guide, so make sure that you check that out. Also, go check out Curse of Lizzie Borden, folks, on Discovery Plus and on Max streaming service, and you'll see what I'm talking about. And I didn't mean for that to turn into a plug for me. I get nothing from that show. It's been out and about for years, but wow, my brain is shattered.
By the way, you know, I just want, if you can give me just a second, you'd asked about evil, the nature of evil.
Yes.
And I'll paraphrase this, but this is from the transcript. Why do I bother with a pathetic blank like Clara Fowler? I do it because it's my job. God is dead. Jesus is in hell. Yet moment to moment, we fight for the souls of humans, sometimes by the thousands, often one at a time, each a small or momentous victory. And we celebrate those victories. Truly, we do. Another secret. Most are borderline, but occasionally we come upon a special case. Borden, Holmes, the Ripper, countless others whose names you will never know. And these, by their own choosing, become me. Evil incarnate, prowling the earth with one purpose, to reduce God's so-called creations to the brutish animals I know them to be. There's kind of an answer to evil in the world.
Yeah. Right. There's no doubt that there's an evil in this world, and that we are capable of so much. And if you don't think that something's clouding the judgment of humans that can just take a life without consideration and thought, think again.
Yes.
Because as broken as we are, humanity is still alive in people, but it is changing, and we are changing as a species now. The world is a very strange place. I still have faith and belief in light and love, and that we can overcome these things. But man, I could see how easy it is to allow the dark side to win, right? How easy it is.
There's a very thin veneer
that
coats us from a lack of civilization, from just, you know, chaos. But there is an anecdote to it, and this is my view. So Bassett is talking to Prince, and he goes, "The demon said it would reshape the world and create the future. I know how to prevent that, how to fight the demon with the only weapon we have." Prince stood waiting. "Acts of kindness, Dr. Prince, acts of kindness."
I like it. Exactly. And that's something we've been touting on the show for years.
Right? That's the weapon against demonic forces.
And therein is also the answer to the theological aspect. It may not be Jesus itself that is repelling the beings, but it is the concept of kindness and love, the concept that doing good simply for the act of doing good and fighting in the name of good, whatever that name you ascribe to it is, that's what's rebuking these beings. That's what's offensive and disgusting to them.
I think so.
They want us all to sink into that mire of darkness and depression and anxiety and hatred that it is obviously. And Ron, we've seen this now for the last 6-8 years, how easy this world can turn, and hatred just burns across the earth.
Well, you know, people talk about the mystery of evil, but few people talk about the mystery of goodness. But really, at the end, if we're just what Darwin says, you know, some microbial growth that just moves towards self-preservation. You know, how do you explain people saving other people's lives? How do you explain people giving their lives up for others? A soldier, for example, saving his platoon, jumping on a grenade, or Mother Teresa working among lepers. How do you explain that if Darwinian theory is the only thing there is, if that's all that's correct? The great mystery maybe isn't evil. The great mystery is good.
Right. And isn't it interesting that you could also look at the perspective of that in order for the greater good to occur, we go into nerd territory here with Star Trek, right? That the good of the many outweigh the good of the one. So what seems like Darwinism in reverse, why would he jump on that, is because in order to move on, if we are one symbiotic being, this universal race of humanity, we are going to push things in order to get up over, right? We can watch fire ants and those horrible ants in the Amazon that will build walls to cross across trees to get to the side they want to get to devour a carcass. Where there is a will, there is a way, and many will die in that process, but the overall arc is we're going to get there as a species. We're going to march on. So evil and good are very real.
And you can see
that line.
If that's the Darwinian inclination, and if that's true, that there's a great force towards living that way, well, then a religious life is totally contradictory to that. Treat your brother as you want to treat yourself, et cetera.
Right.
You know, and so basically there's your struggle. There is the struggle between good and evil. This sort of gravity that pushes us down, and hope, which pushes us up. That's the battle.
The book is called The Unwelcomed, and you never know what kind of book or thing will cross your path that will open up an amazing conversation and peel the scales from your eyes and the hands from your ears to allow you to see and hear things maybe in a new and respective light. And Ron, the book is going to be out again in May. You've got it available for pre-order right now. You're doing great with pre-order. We're fingers crossed, we're hoping you explode with this book, and we'll see a movie version of it at some point so we can see this fully realized tale. Do you know, as you were working through this case, I'm sure other things came into your orbit. Are there other cases and other stories that seem almost like cyclical nature of time and evil and good happening over and over again.
I try to write it. Like I said, I was in law enforcement for a while, and so you tend to look at things in a pretty logical way if you can. You know, you set it up. What are the possibilities? And so I set the book up that way, in the sense that I put a lot of case histories to sort of document and build the argument that demonic possession is real. And there's probably a half dozen really interesting, fascinating cases that help to support the Clara Fowler study.
Remarkable. Good stuff.
One more incredible than the other.
Yeah. And Ron, I definitely want to get you back on, because I know that you have a great overview kind of the concept of interdimensional beings and things, which, you know, looking at creatures like Bigfoot, looking at creatures like aliens and sea creatures and the demonic realm, angelic realm, is this all one of the same thing? We're just all taking bites from a different piece of the pie, so it tastes like a different element of what it is that we're experiencing.
Well, one of the things that struck me after, you know, really studying the Mojave incident tapes and just everything for years, and then doing this for years, is the parallels between demonic possession and alien abduction. You know, they're very, very, you know, I could list them and put them together in a parallel diagram that would at least have somebody, even a skeptic, saying, well, that's sure a coincidence.
Yeah, and what a coincidence. Keep your eyes open, folks. Sometimes the synchronicities are glaring. The stories that are compelling you to find them are right there. You just have to awaken to them, come out of the matrix, if you will. And
that's so true. Notice.
Ron. Go ahead.
Actually, I was just watching a show. It was Unsolved Mysteries. It comes on sometimes on my TV, whether I tune it in or not. But anyway, it was about Fatima in Portugal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you look at what they describe, you know, in terms of these lights in the sky, flashing lights, this beatific, this beautiful woman that's clearly transcendental, that's a visitor. And you look at what the miracle was, which is the sun dancing in the sky and acting like it was going to come and then being pulled back. You could make a case that that's a UFO experience very, very easily.
Yeah, no doubt. Cool stuff. Ron, before we leave, what do you want to leave people with this evening, whether it's about the book or just life in general? And again, the book, The Unwelcome, The Curious Case of Clara Fowler, is out and available for pre-order right now. There's a link on today's program guide. Ron Felber, our guest. Ron, what would you like to share with our listeners before we say goodbye?
If I had to share anything, it would be that individuals matter. That people till their own acre and can become a sort of a shining example for others that follow suit. And if enough people follow suit, it's a very good thing.
I couldn't agree more. Ron, thank you so much. Great catching up with you again, sir.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, Dave. Thank you.
We won't wait so long to do it again.
I hope not.
Okay. I appreciate that. What a remarkable guest and a remarkable talk this evening. Went in a direction I had no clue was coming my way, but that's great. Because again, my entire journey throughout the paranormal has been one of evolution, of kind of adopting the philosophy of the type of martial arts that Bruce Lee did, but with the mind and concept of understanding life as it exists around us. Instead of being a stoic rock who just takes things as it pounds him, I like to go with the flow and learn along the way. And I think because of that, it's allowed me to remain open to these different possibilities and concepts that are right there, right before our very eyes. And I hope that you have had an opportunity to not only just hear shows like this, but that you take something from them, that the darkness of this world is just a little more light with the information that we share here. And I want to thank you very much for allowing me into your world and for allowing yourselves into mine so that we can share these stories, so that we can share these ideals. And I real quick mention a couple of neat things coming up. May 4th and 5th, I'm going to be in Mankato at the psychic, paranormal, and wellness fair. There's information up on our website at darknessevents.com. And Hillview Manor is coming up May 11th. And I'm going to be out at Hillview Manor doing a full investigation, Q&A. Great opportunity to come on out, mix, mingle, talk, hang out. There's tickets and information on our website, again, at darknessevents.com. And I would love to see you face-to-face, hear your stories, and share elements of our experience together. So until Wednesday, when we're back with the strange and wonderful Supernatural News Crew, thank you again for being here with me this evening, and I hope that you took something away from tonight's show that'll make you think. And I hope that you'll pick up a copy of Ron Felber's book, and when you do, make sure to rate and review it when you get a chance. So that way, more and more people can find the great works from the authors that we have here. That's it for tonight. I'm Dave Schrader, and thank you for visiting my Paranormal 60. Make sure to check it out. Theater of the Mind, Tales from the Darkness is available now on Amazon.com in paperback and ebook format. You can find it there. Go sign up, get yourself a copy. Don't miss out on some of the spooky. We can share it together. Theater of the Mind, Tales from the Darkness. And make sure that you rate and review the book